Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the second part of the French Connection today. As I said in the first segment, we are pleased to have a return visitor, Reverend Ted Pike. You know Ted if you've been listening to the French Connection for any time at all. And I've got to be honest with you, this man has worked with me on so many issues, free speech issues, on some of the machinations that we've had to go through regarding this this criminal Jewish leadership, as Ted refers to them. I call them Zionists, or I'm starting to find both of them quite apropos. But more importantly here, what Ted and I are actually asking you for in this is, first, we want to inform you, but we need your help. This is not a fight either of us can win on our own. And as I talked to you in the first segment about how important it is for you to pick up the mantle of this battle, because this is really a people's fight. This is a fight for our sovereignty, our future, and in Ted's case, you know, his very practice of his religion is at risk from these people. So the entire thing that we have had as a wonderful nation has really been undermined by these folks. And because of that, it's going to take us as a group, the 10,000 listening now and the 10,000 you're all going to bring to the show next week, I hope. Just find one person per week and we just take over the place. Anyway, welcome, Ted. It's nice to have you with me.
Thanks so much, Daryl.
Well, you know, here's the thing. Each time we've always tried to talk about a theme or you know, bring new information to the folks. And I did ask you, I know you're very busy and you've been working on trying to make sure that, you know, certain issues are brought up with your constituents and the people that you communicate with regularly. Your last big fight was with this show, Daniel, that actually you were quite successful. Many people across the country were outraged by what these controllers, these evil Jewish controllers of our media had put forward as family programming or even any programming, and it was offensive in the extreme. And I'm wondering if you could talk to us about that and maybe the parallel that these same people have done with the images of Muhammad, because they're not very different, Ted. They're different mediums, but the insult is the same, aren't they?
Yes. Well, I was very concerned, like millions of Christian conservatives and lovers of free speech in America, about a month ago when NBC sent out its first programs of the Book of Daniel, which is a mockery. It's in comedy form, but it's a travesty, a mockery of basically the time-honored tradition of the Christian family. And this series had Reverend, I should say, he's called Father. He's an Anglican priest. Father Daniel Webster is this confused, drug-addicted cleric who is compromising with the mafia. And then his daughter is a 14-year-old daughter is a drug pusher. His 23-year-old Republican son is a homosexual. His secretary is a lesbian. His wife is an alcoholic, and so on. It was just egregious. It was over the top. And fortunately, the forces of the conservative right were blitzing NBC and so on. But unfortunately, these people, good-hearted as they may be, do not have the nerve or the temerity to actually specify who was behind that or the last temptation of Christ in years past and so on. They refer to them as the secular media, the liberals, the media moguls, all of these obscure terms.
Doesn't the name Zucker come into play here, this man?
Yeah.
Zucker?
Well, anyway, I just I started investigating, and I found out that even though General Electric owns NBC, was bought out from the Sarnoff dynasty back in the late 80s, nevertheless, even though the top executives, the administrative staff of NBC is primarily GE executives of a Gentile background, nevertheless, the real creativity, the real program management for entertainment, network entertainment in America, is in the hands of Jeff Zucker, who is a very determined anti-Christian Jew. He is in complete charge of all entertainment programming of NBC. and has tremendous power. His bio is very impressive. I think he's received 7 Academy Awards for his productions. He specializes in producing edgy type of comedies and programming. And if he doesn't actually produce it, he's behind it, endorsing it. You know, things like Will and Grace, which is
That's absolutely the most offensive program I've ever seen. Ted, I want to talk to you, you know, because the community that honors this man is the same community that we're fighting against, in fact. And in fact, you know, if they're out to crush the Christian moral values and destroy the moral compass of America, then my take on it is that they've been giving themselves awards for their success in doing so, in doing
yeah.
that.
Yeah, well, it was the same thing with the Golden Globe Awards. The homosexual agenda was honored. There was the Brokeback Mountain movie, which was lavished with awards. That's a pro-homosexual movie about two homosexual cowboys. It was a Transamerica a movie about transgenders, and then there was even the Capote movie featuring and emphasizing homosexuality as a legitimate alternate lifestyle and so on. And there's a very definite tendency in the media to break down Christian values, to assault Christian morality, the Christian foundation. All of our symbols, our traditions, our values, and so on are clearly under full-scale
attack.
Well,
let's talk now, then, about this same group of people. And I'll tell you, we've got to jump over to Europe for this part of it. And then it goes back to America. All the newspapers in Europe, both here in France and even in England, of course up in Denmark where it started, made the Muhammad the you know the Messiah to the Muslim community, their prophet. He was shown to be a bomb-toting rocket in his hat kind of guy. And as you and I both know, to even have an image of him is sacrilegious to the Muslims.
Yes. Yes.
And they took the same assaultive tone against the Islam as they have against Christians. And it's the same group of media moguls. They just happen to be over here in Europe, but under the same controlling mechanisms, Ted.
Yes. Well, there's an arrogance about these evil Jewish leaders and their media monopolies. I think they're feeling that they are in such control now, they are in such media domination, literally, of a whole world, that they can throw their weight around, they can become aggressive, they can fast-track their agenda in a more determined way, a more blatant way than they ever have before. And, of course, this can provide two types of reactions. People can resist in a similarly vulgar or demonstrative way which actually throws fuel into the fire and legitimately creates the impression of anti-Semitism around the world, or they can respond as I have responded with facts, with documentation, with clear-headed and sober recommendations that these people be identified. And what my strategy is to actually identify these evil Jewish leaders in the media or wherever they manifest themselves, so that the Jewish community itself worldwide will begin to get nervous, and they themselves will put pressure on their brethren in the media. And I think that's what happened with the Last Temptation of Christ movie several decades ago, 15 years ago. The MCA Jewish moguls of Hollywood were actually threatening several more films, even more blasphemous than The Last Temptation of Christ. And yet what I did was I picked up on a statement by Jerry Falwell, basically inferring that the Jews were behind the movie. This was widespread in America. Every pastor in the country knew of Falwell's statement. And our National Prayer Network sent out 192,000 brochures to pastors in America alerting to them of the Jewish authorship behind that movie, and also the fact that it was a precise reflection of the attitudes of the Talmud toward Jesus. We use these sober facts and documentation, and about 10 years later, a national Jewish representative said that The Last Temptation of Christ actually was the greatest public relations disaster between Jews and Christians in pretty much the last century. Now, I am not wanting to create public relations disasters between Jews of good intention and Christians, by no means, but I am wanting to put the pressure on these Jewish tycoons and media manipulators when they get too aggressive, to let them know that we are going to inform not only the Christians, but the Jewish community, and hopefully we'll have a scissor action, a pincher action, as both Christians and Jews exert pressure on these media tyrants.
Well, you know, here's the next question about this, though. You and I have done research that most people will never get as far as, or when they do, it will come after they've got a good basis in knowledge. And one of the things that I've discovered is they've got a plan afoot here, and one of their plans is to foment the kinds of discord and hatred and just anger among both Christians and Jews, or I mean not Jews, Christians and Muslims around the world, both against one another and against them, the Jews themselves. And they've done it here in Europe with these young men here in the what they call the banlieue, the ghetto areas of France.
Yes.
And they've actually lit the fuses of these places to cause these problems. Now they're doing it with this horrendous depiction of their prophet as a bomb-riding, sicko terrorist. And, I mean, Ted, rank-and-file people, at least the Muslims here stood up and said, that's outrageous.
Yeah.
I mean, we can't get that kind of play in America. I mean, we should have been outraged by this show, Daniel. And instead, it was left up to the pastors to fight the fight, not the rank-and-file. I'm wondering what it is about the American experience that's keeping the rank-and-file Christians from being outraged in their own right.
Well, actually, Donald Wildman, the head of the American Family Association, claimed that fairly early in the protest, he'd gotten 500,000 letters or calls going into NBC Universal. There was pretty widespread anger. Dobson and other people, Focus on the Family, they militated against it and so on. I think what we have is there often is the problem is not getting the Christians worked up. The problem is getting the Christians to have enough nerve and get out of their propaganda conditioning enough that they can actually say the forbidden J word and say that these are Jews and they represent evil Jewish leadership attempting to subvert Christian civilization. Now, that's asking an awful lot for them, and very few of us have the courage to go out into the public arena and make that announcement in that specific way. But
well, here's my bailiwick, and I decided with Eric, my partner in this battle, that unless we identified them for whom they were, we weren't going to actually make any change in this situation. And,
no.
You know, you've been brave enough to do it. I'm doing it. I see movement, Ted, in America. I see the question of Zionism being brought on many, many more lips now than when we started.
Yes.
6 months ago, if you even typed in Zionism in your Google, you got about 30 or 40 hits. Check it now.
Uh-huh.
It's in the thousands.
Really?
And if you check on Zionist and the rest of it, you're beginning to see a lot of current discussions on boards and everything. So there has been some movement, and this is why I wanted you on today, because I asked you to examine a couple of things and hear and listen to a couple of things that I've been doing lately. One of them was on the 13th Tribe, which you had heard of before and known about, and actually you said that you had some information from. But the other was, both Benjamin Friedman's work, which you had read the transcript of,
yes,
and how that story relates to the leadership of these Jewish organizations that are in control. It was interesting to note that in the book The 13th Tribe, how the northern part of this of the Sabbateans movement ended up in Bavaria at some point and then exported to America.
Yes.
And the interesting part of that situation is that they came over to establish messianic lodges, which is what Muhammad pointed out so cleverly.
Yeah.
The facts are that these people have used a very clandestine policy of manipulation over the long term. They're not short term thinkers, are they, Ted?
No, absolutely not.
Well, what was maybe eye opening to you in your first read through and listen through of the information?
Well, certainly the Friedman, the transcript of the Friedman tape was just tremendously unlocking of some of the hidden reasons, the mysteries behind such momentous events as the First and the Second World War and so mm-hmm. on, and why the German people were, I would say, driven to desperation to take measures against the international Jewish bankers and so on, who
yep.
had basically shafted them at Versailles, who had perpetuated the First World War when it could have been ended, and on and on. And the Uttermeyer recommendation, and all of that is what was very enlightening. I found Mohammed Arafik's talk, 2 hours of that, just to be spellbinding. He's a most educated person.
Yes, he not only is, he's a genuinely sincere man. And I,
uh-huh.
you know, the people that I'm talking to with him are also sincere about getting the truth out, because, look, they see the threat to their religion. And you have to remember, to the listeners in America at least, that the Muslim and Christian community were not at war with each other until the foment, until the anger was instilled in the relationship. And much of that was actually designed, and I want to give a little history lesson here. Wahhabism was a creation of the Jewish Mossad group, exported to Saudi Arabia, used the money from Saudi princes under the direction of these Jews who created it, to incite the Muslims around the world, specifically in Iran, in Pakistan, and in other parts of North Africa, to revolt. And you've seen the result of this radicalization of Islam in both Algeria, where 150,000 murders were committed by radical Islam, which was a creation of the Jews. And then you can see the same thing happening in Pakistan under the madrasas, as well as through Iran. And now what they were trying to do, and I want to just bring people up to date here, is they want to create a radicalized Islam so that they have a created enemy for Christian America to be angry with and go to war with, and they've been very successful.
That's right.
Well, this is an awful thing to do. This is as horrible a thing to do to two great monotheistic religions as anything I can think of.
Sure. Well, you know, it wasn't an accident, in my opinion, that within a week of the arrest of David Irving in Austria and the deportation of Germar Rudolph from Chicago, and of course Ernst Zundel is still there, was previously there in a German prison. Within a week of those two outrageous usurpations of these men's rights, the president of Iran comes out with this bold statement, not only denying the Holocaust, but threatening the extermination of Israel and so on. Just extremely volatile language. And what it seemed to do on the national and international scene was to tie in questions of scholarly questions, in my opinion, about perhaps the fact that the full 6 million numbers of the Holocaust might not be accurate, which is what David Irving affirms, tying in legitimate Holocaust reductionism with an attempt to destroy Israel and exterminate the Jewish people, you see.
What they said in essence, though, I got to clarify just a tad here. They said that Israel's right to exist is questionable, both by the vote of the General Assembly of the United Nations, which soundly and roundly voted against the Israelis ever starting that country. Now let's jump over just a tad here again to what was said by Mohammed Rafik. While there were Jewish trading communities throughout Khazaria, and there were Sephardic rabbis brought in from Spain, in fact, that's where they got most of them in the 9th, 10th, and 11th centuries. They brought them in from Spain to teach their population. They were, by and large, a converted group of people, Khazars. Of course, they had Mongol blood in them ultimately, and they also had Turkish blood or Turkic blood,
yeah.
As well as you know, some even Byzantium Christian blood in there, mixed up all together. But they were Khazarian when they converted.
Right.
And here's the interesting thing that most people didn't realize, Ted. And this country was sandwiched between the Christian Empire out of Constantinople, and to their south, the Islamic republics that were run by caliphs.
Yes.
And had they joined either one of the camps to become either Muslim or Christian, they would have had an immediate enemy of the other side.
Yes.
And what they chose to do was quite diplomatic. Now, imagine having a diplomatic reason to become a believer in a religion. Well, that's really the basis for the beginning of this, according to Muhammad and according to what the 13th tribe really spells out. Now, that doesn't mean they didn't become more religiously orientated as time progressed, but certainly it was a political decision by their Kagan or their king.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Now, what we look at now, Ted, is the same group is not, by and large, Semitic. However, there was intermarriage from some of the Semitic tribes, I would imagine, but they were still a nation of many millions. And the Semitic bloodline in them is very minute in relation to what their Khazarian blood is.
Absolutely.
And so it's kind of like their right to return to Israel would be predicated on the fact that they had to have been there in the first place.
Well,
but having been Khazars, by and large, that society had never been
it's pretty preposterous. You know, I have a somewhat different take from Muhammad, and maybe I could share that with you.
Mm-hmm.
You see, basically what the case that he is making, and perhaps you are making, is that this radical infusion of Khazarian, and that's Japhetic blood, Gentile blood, not related to any Semitic ancestry, what this does is a real body blow against the whole evangelical movement.
Yes, it is, Ted.
But here's my take on it. This is very interesting. It's a body blow on the whole eschatology, the prophetic scenario of God preserving his chosen people through the millennia and then bringing them back to Palestine at the second coming of Christ and so on. That's not the way I look at it at all. You see, in order to understand, and I'll be talking here from a Christian perspective, in order to really understand what has happened to the Jewish people, we have to go back to the book of Deuteronomy in chapter 28. Now, this is the great classic warning where Moses gathers the Hebrews together, and he proposes a great blessing on the Jewish people or a great curse, depending upon whether they are obedient to God. Now, the blessing is very munificent. You know, you'll be healthy and happy, and you'll be prosperous and you'll be a large nation, all these things if you obey God's commandments. But the flip side of that is this terrible, terrible curses that go on for several chapters in Deuteronomy. Now, one of the things which Moses says is, if you do not obey the Lord your God and keep his commandments, his benevolent commandments of justice, righteousness, and mercy, and so on, as well as the keeping of his law, he says, you will be few in number. And also he says, and that's Deuteronomy 28:62, he says, you'll be few in number, you'll be a small country in judgment for your sins. And also he says, there will be aliens in your midst who will rule over you. And that's in Deuteronomy 28:43.
Now that would fit perfectly in with this sect of Ashkenazis who are ruling over Sephardi right now.
Absolutely. And in that very chapter, he describes how that aliens actually were already in their midst and came as Egyptians. The Egyptians had come with the Hebrews out of Egypt, and they were very, very familiar with the idea of intermarriage between were the Gentiles who wanted to embrace the God of Israel and so on. Now, let me just backtrack a little bit. The general policy of the Old Testament law was don't intermarry with the heathen nations around you. This was not out of racistic motivations. This was because God didn't want the Hebrews marrying in to these idolatrous nations and basically destroying his whole plan and experiment for the Jewish people. But there are many, many instances all throughout the Old Testament of the Jewish people engrafting in worthy Gentiles like Ruth the Moabitess, who married Boaz and became the grandmother of David, King David himself. David was not a pure Jew. He was at least a quarter Moabite. And then we have Rahab the harlot, who was from Jericho, becoming a mother in Israel. We have all kinds of these punctuated all throughout.
We have Jewish princesses marrying Hittite kings as well Turkish region.
Speaking of Hittites, one of David's most valiant warriors was the husband of Bathsheba, whom David seduced, and that was Uriah the Hittite. Well, as Rafik was saying yesterday, the Hittites were very closely allied genetically with the Khazars. So here already in the time of David, you had essentially perhaps a Khazar warrior of the highest moral character being a front fighter for David in his wars for the nation of Israel. Well, these are just kind of cross-sections.
Now, what you're saying to me then is that this has been farcical from the very beginning, because...
No, that's not...
Well, wait a minute. Let me make this point, because if there has been... There was actually, according to Muhammad, a great deal of proselytizing of the Jews, the Jewish community, during the first and second centuries of the modern era, to attract people throughout northern Africa to Judaism, and in fact, even the Sephardi practiced it. Now, here's the question: if so many have, over the two millennia plus time, have married into Sephardiism, and then a huge community of Khazars have about 90% of their blood coming from the Turkic area, then there is verily an individual or truly just one or two people in the world that can claim pure Jewish blood, or any for that matter.
And what I'm saying is that's been true all throughout the Bible. And what we have to realize here is that God did require certain standards of racial isolation from the idolaters surrounding them, but in the Old Testament, in the book of Leviticus, the Hebrews went out and defeated the Midianites, and God actually allowed 32,000 unwed virgins out of the Midianites to become the mothers of Israel, to be engrafted into Israel, making up about one out of every 10 mothers for the next generation. Now, here's my point, and here we go away from genetics and heredity into the spiritual realm, and that is that God's work through the Hebrew people was not a racistic work. It was not a work defined solely by race or racial purity, heredity, genes, and that. That was kind of the skeleton down beneath as a kind of a way of holding together his great work, and he allowed generous exceptions to that, often according to the worthiness of the Gentiles that he wanted to bring in. But what he was mainly concerned about was using a physical, fleshly people in order to create and to perpetuate a great spiritual and moral work of the ages, culminating in creating a land and a place and a people receptive to the actual coming of Christ in the fullness of time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this has to be remembered. This has to be remembered because always there was this compromise going on. Even in the bloodline of Jesus Christ, in the bloodline of David, you have Moabite blood in there in person of Ruth coming right in. And this is all very spiritual because it anticipates and symbolizes the engrafting, the eventual engrafting of the Gentiles of faith, those who do the righteous works of Abraham in spirit and in truth, into the spiritual blessings of Israel. And so even Paul in the New Testament says, we are the Israel of God. The Gentiles who do the works of Abraham, spiritually speaking, can become heirs of his promises.
Now let's talk about the modern politics and the use of these ancient concepts to manipulate and to lie.
Well,
now,
just a second, if we could, this is very important that I continue.
Okay, go ahead.
Continue this. We'll get into that in just a minute, if you will. Now, here's the fascinating thing, and that is that God cursed the Jewish people that if they did not obey his commands, they would always be a tiny people. They would always be a tiny people, and also he said that aliens would be in their midst dominating them. Now, let me just launch a bombshell and tell you that the Jews were under God's curse. They always remained a relatively small people, especially after they did have Jesus Christ crucified 2,000 years ago. I mean, you can't get any more disobedient than that. You cannot create a greater outrage against God's law than actually crucifying the giver of that law, Jesus Christ. And so the Jews went into the diaspora as a very small people. Now, we find instances of Jews, of course, in fairly large numbers in Spain. They are the classical Sephardim. We find small numbers of Jews in Germany in the time of Luther. We find small numbers of Jews in Holland in the time of Rembrandt and so on. They were scattered around, but they were a small people, and that was a fulfillment, in my opinion, of this perpetual curse. You'll always be a small people. Now, here's the amazing thing. The scriptures are also full of this very potent idea that the Jews will ascend into domination, actually, of the nations. And in the book of Revelation, we find the great harlot, which I believe is Israel, ruling over the kings of the earth. Now, here's the question. How can a people who are condemned to be a very small people actually rise to world ascendancy? Well, here, in my opinion, is the way God made it happen. He brought along these warlike, artistic, merchant-oriented, financially adroit Khazars, Turkic, Hunnish stock. He brought them in, and he gave a huge booster shot to Israel, and the Jews of Babylon, the rabbis of Babylon, were able to go up into Khazaria from their academies in Sura and Pumbedith and elsewhere, infusing them with this rabbinic, Talmudic megalomania, including the Zohar, the precursor of the Zohar, the Talmud, and basically they made the Khazars into seven times more the children of the devil than they were. And Jesus even said, you Pharisees, you compass sea and land to make one proselyte in order that he could become seven times a children of hell than you were. Now, here's what I believe is a profound fulfillment of Scripture, which is lasting even to this very moment. And that is, if we go to Israel today, we find anywhere from 80% to 90% of in fact, I should say in the world, we find 80 or 90% of world so-called Jewry is Khazar or Ashkenazim. These are the aliens who come in like, you know, it's like a cuckoo bird and dwelling in the nest of Israel, and they're five times the size of the mother bird, you know, the cuckoo bird story. And they've come in and they've taken over the nest, and they are oppressing the legitimate Sephardic tiny minority within Judaism. And I don't buy the idea that the Sephardim are all intermarried the way that, I mean, they've been totally intermarried. There's been some, but I believe we're much more entitled to call the so-called Sephardim Oriental actual legitimate descendants of the tribe of Judah. Now, here's the amazing thing. You know, there's a book which is very interesting. It's by Jack Bernstein. It's called An American Jew in Racist Marxist Israel. Have you ever heard of that?
No.
Yeah, it's a fascinating book. He was an Ashkenazi Jew who, in idealism, moved over to Israel back, I think, in the 1980s or whatever, and he was all filled with this patriotic Jewish fervor and everything, frontier mentality there. And he fell in love with a beautiful Sephardic girl. He was Ashkenazi. She was Sephardic. He fell in love with her and married her, and suddenly his whole world collapsed on him because he and his Sephardic wife suddenly became the victims of terrible discrimination of Israel in Israel, and he came to realize that in housing, in employment, in basic services, and so on, the Sephardic are terribly oppressed by the dominant ruling elite in Israel, which is Ashkenazi or Khazar. And the fact is, though, in Israel, 60% of Israelis are Sephardic. There's a very high relative number of Sephardic in Israel, but there's this ruling elite of Khazars, which are very vindictive against them. They are the aliens dwelling in Israel who are ruling over them with rigor and with violence, discrimination against them.
Well, here's what I'd like to bring out, okay?
Uh-huh.
They've used this term, Semitic, as an
uh-huh.
advantage they've taken against anybody who stands up against them. Now, here's the interesting thing. The purest Semitic race on this planet is Palestinians. They are Semitic, and that is their genetic code is a Semitic background.
They are Ishmaelites. They are the Arab world is descended from Ishmael. But what most people don't understand is that Ishmael was the son of Hagar, who was a pure Egyptian. You see, Abraham and Sarah were so frustrated in getting the promised heir, Isaac, that Sarah actually recommended that Abraham sleep with her mistress, her bondservant, Hagar the Egyptian. Now that's Hamitic blood. And so it was out of the pure Semitic blood of Abraham mixed with Hagar, Hamitic blood, that the whole world of Ishmael was created, the Arab world. And in fact, a prophecy was made there by God to Hagar when she was exiled by Sarah, that this child, Ishmael, the father of the Arab world, will be a donkey of a man. Every man's hand will be against him, and his hand will be against all men, and so on, you see. But most people, you know, they say, well, the Arabs are just as much Semitic as even the Sephardic Jews. That's not true. The Arab world is half Hamitic. And if we go even back to the curse on Ham in Noah's time for Ham's homosexuality against Noah, we find that basically there's an implication that the descendants of Ham will never rise to preeminence over the nations the way Japheth will and ultimately Shem will at the top of the hierarchy. So I think that has to be clarified.
That's not what the research has been saying. Biological research of the bloodlines of Palestine show that in every sense their genetics are almost 99.999% identical in the area of the genome that issues forth racial difference.
Uh-huh.
And
well,
so that they are so alike that they, in fact, they are far more alike with the Sephardics than Sephardis are with Khazarian.
Oh, yeah.
And now here's the interesting thing.
Uh-huh.
There are many Ashkenazi Khazars who, of course, they're the first people in America who claim anti-Semitism. And they don't have the right to claim that. They're not even
right.
Semitic.
Yeah.
And
well,
here's the thing. When you can actually, in where I live, be jailed for speaking to an Ashkenazi, and the crime is anti-Semitism.
Uh-huh. Absolutely.
And it becomes a crime, but you're not. This is like saying to an Irishman something nasty about a Roman,
yeah,
and going to jail for it.
Of course,
it makes.
Well,